the constant tension and the feeling of being all alone in a world of speed and danger. These are race drivers, dedicated men with a special skill which they've developed over many hazardous years of driving. With precision and smoothness, they search for the shortest way around. And like a soldier under fire, they believe that it's always the other guy who may be killed. Why do these men risk their lives day after day? Well, some say for glory, others fame, wealth, and of course, the pure love of speed. These daredevils of the speedway are like dope addicts who can't break away. It takes more than speed and courage to be a great race driver. Luck and driving know-how play a large part in winning. In 1911, Ray Haroon felt that tire construction was the key to winning. At 75 miles per hour, tire wear would be held to a minimum, while at 77 or 80 miles per hour, most tires would last less than an hour. He also needed a reliable engine that would run all day at 75 miles per hour. He found the right combination and in 1911 won the first Indianapolis 500. There have been many great drivers who could not find the right winning combination, and one of these drivers was Tony Bettenhausen. He was almost unbeatable on the dirt tracks, but could not find the winning groove at Indianapolis. Tony had this to say about being a race driver.
I feel that certain people are cut out to be carpenters. Another man might be cut out to be an engineer. Another one a policeman. Well, I feel racing is my living, and if I was to have racing taken from me, why, I would be losing everything that I had attained through the past 20 years.
The fabulous career of Tony Bettenhausen came to an end on May 12, 1961, when a bolt dropped out of the steering controls of a car that he was testing. He'd been upside down 29 times, and the thing he feared most was fire. Roger Ward, twice national driving champion and winner of the 1959 and 1962 Indianapolis 500, had this to say about racing.
It requires the desire more than anything else. You have to really want to do this because it's something that is a little bit dangerous, you might say, and however, we don't think of it that way, but it's a profession that you have to want to do pretty bad because there are lots of other ways of making it. In 1955, on the back straightaway, when Billy Vukovich was killed, I slid down the back straightaway backwards. I knew I was going into the wall. I never had enough time to think about it.
Roger retired from auto racing in 1966 after nearly being involved in a 17-car accident. He said that racing wasn't fun anymore. Driving a high-powered race car at tremendous speeds, lap after lap, is a hard, grueling business. And in both qualifying and racing, a driver must know how he is to drive this track. We asked several rookies if they had trouble adjusting to the track.
Well, other than the extreme high speed, no, really, there isn't. It's a fun track to drive, really. I've really enjoyed the place.
Well, it's an entirely different ball game. I'm used to running road courses, and this is my first oval track. So the combination of the high speed and being oval, you have to play the corners entirely different. You play them almost like a straightaway, and that's something that takes me a lot of getting used to, I think. And I don't have any trouble with the first turn here on the front straight. That seems natural to get into there and into the fast line, but on number three, I still want to play it like a sports car.
The only place I seem to have trouble on this racetrack is the number two turn. It seems to flatten out just a little bit, and I have a harder time getting off it than I do any place else. The other turn, like number three turn, is if all four was like it, anybody could run around here, I think, 180 miles. Now you can get through it with no trouble at all. But we're not sure I understand there are some extra bumps that have been developed this year due to weather, snow or something, and it's given them some trouble in the first turn.
I know it's a lot bumpier. That's one of the reasons that we're finding the speed so difficult to attain. That's the reason for the big separation between the piston car speeds and the jet speed. With their big exhaust pipe, it's pointing straight up in the air. They're getting 70 pounds of thrust straight up in the air, which is actually pushing the car down to the ground 70 pounds worth, and they're not flying through the air going over the bumps in number one corner like what we are. And this has a detrimental factor on your speed.
And how does a veteran driver see the speedway? Well, what does he look for?
Well, the biggest thing you have to worry about is what the other fellow is doing. You're running at such a high rate of speed that you have to drive a long ways in front of you. And if you see somebody in trouble, let's say, 100 yards at least in front of you, well, you're gonna be there before you really know what's going on, you know. And they have no control over the car, so this is one thing that you have to watch out for, is the other fellow. And as far as speed goes, be careful not to get down in a corner too deep and then get back after too late, because this cuts back your speed. Well, the thing you have to remember about this racetrack is you have two long straightaways and two short straightaways. You can make more time, or you can make faster time, by accelerating hard through the short end of the racetrack than you can driving real deep down the long straightaways and then braking hard and then picking up the accelerator and trying to get across the short end of the track. You just have to keep building up your momentum across the short end of the racetrack, and as you do, you find yourself backing off sooner and sooner down the long straight.
Well, it's the way I look at it, it's four individual turns and four straightaways, two long ones and two short ones, and each one has to be approached properly, and if you don't, you'll lose time on the clock. As far as the jets and the piston engines are concerned, now the jet cars haven't been running on a mile track, so we don't really know how they'll run. And we have some 20-odd races in a season.
Well, really, you can run all over the world, and no racetrack will prepare you for Indianapolis. This is a whole new ball game when you get here. There is nothing really that you could compare this to. It's like perhaps running or practicing driving your car in your back alley, so to speak, and then pull out on an interstate. There's considerable difference there, and there's considerable difference here. The speeds are terrific, and the track is narrow, and it's very demanding. It calls for a study in precise precision driving and strictly with the throttle, and there's no guesswork allowed here.
Automobile racing is a dangerous sport, and those who participate in it know the chances they take. Don Edmonds and Al Herman describe what it's like to be in an accident.
Oh, my eyes get kind of big and my hair stands on end a little bit. All you see is grandstand, racetrack, just flashes and everything. I know the first time I ever got upside down, actually, was the first race I ever drove, and I didn't know that I was getting upside down. It happened so quick, I didn't know what was happening. And I thought I was just getting through the corner, and I thought, gee, this race is awful rough. Just kind of took away my interest there for about, a month or so. I thought, gee, I don't know if I like this or not. You know, I hit the wall.
all three times coming down a straightaway here. And every time I hit, I just kept thanking the Lord that I was still alive. Because I had knocked the wind out of me, but I was still feeling awful good because I knew I was still here.
In 1955, Bill Vukovich, who was attempting to become the first driver in history to win three consecutive 500s, however, while leading on the 57th lap, Bill was fatally injured in a four-car accident. The officials at the Speedway take every precaution to ensure the safety of the drivers. Tony Holman, president of the Speedway, holds a driver's meeting before every race.
I know how much you all want to win the race. I don't blame you. There's a lot of hazards here and a lot of danger. And let's have just a little heart for everybody and everything down there tomorrow and try to get this over without any accidents or anything like that. And try to be what you all are, champions. When you go down there, let's look like we're a regular racing organization and we know how to start a race. And from the bottom of my heart, I hope every one of you the best of luck.
And now...
Now, now, cried the Queen. Faster, faster. And a little later, in Through the Looking Glass, Lewis Carroll had the Queen remark, "It takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that." This is the place where everyone is going faster and faster. It was appropriately named the Indianapolis Speedway, and no one here has ever kept running in the same place. In 1925, Peter Paolo, driving a Duesenberg, became the first Indianapolis winner to average more than 100 miles per hour when he averaged 101.13 miles per hour for the 500 miles. A unique entry that year was the first front-wheel drive car at Indianapolis, entered by Miller Engine Works and driven to second place by Dave Lewis. Lou Schneider won the 1931 500 in this Bowl Seal Fast Special powered by an 8-cylinder Miller engine despite a challenge from many passenger car manufacturers. Miller engines finished first, third, and fourth, while the only threat from the semi-stocks came from Studebaker, who finished fifth. A Cummings diesel, the first ever entered at Indy, proved its dependability by going the full distance without a pit stop, but finished an unimpressive 13th. The Miller engine, under its new owner, Fred Offenhauser, continued its supremacy by capturing the first four places in 1934, and Kelly Petillo won in this Miller-powered car in 1935 as the first 12 finishers were Miller engines. Wilbur Shaw, the 1937 winner, interrupted the long string of 11 consecutive Miller-Offenhauser victories by leading the field home in 1939 and 1940 at the wheel of this Maserati imported from Italy in 1941. Harry Miller designed this four-wheel drive car, the Gulf Oil Miller Special, with a six-cylinder engine mounted behind the driver. It was the first rear-engine car to qualify at Indianapolis. The car placed 28th and was forced out after completing only 22 laps with transmission trouble. 1946 was the year of the fabulous Novi when it was born. Ralph Hepburn piloted the powerful V8 engine to a new one-lap record of 134.499 miles per hour and a qualifying speed of 133.944 miles per hour, 5 miles per hour faster than anyone else. This crowd pleaser and sentimental favorite qualified for the pole position 6 times during its 20-year history, but never won a 500. In the late 40s and early 50s, many new innovations came to Indianapolis. Lighter metals enabled designers to attain better power-to-weight ratios. Improved tires and fuel additives contributed to a steady increase in speed. Bill Vukovich won in 1953 with a new roadster-type car with the engine and drive shaft offset to the left. He also became the first driver in 500 history to average better than 130 miles an hour for the full distance. 1961 was the first threat to the Offenhauser reign at Indianapolis when the Cooper Car Company of England entered a rear-engine Cooper Climax driven by Jack Brabham. The pre-race prediction that the rear-engine car would revolutionize closed-circuit racing in this country appeared premature. The British entry finished ninth, a full 8 minutes behind winner A.J. Foyt driving a conventional Offie Roadster. The foreign invasion was on by 1963, and the days of the Roadsters were numbered. Colin Chapman brought over a team of rear-engine Ford-powered Lotuses from England, and with Scotsman Jim Clark and American Dan Gurney driving them, it took an exceptional effort by Parnelli Jones to win in an Offie. Speed was also in the news. This was the first year qualifiers averaged over 150 miles per hour as 7 drivers bettered the mark. A Scotsman completed the remodeling of the world's biggest automobile race, May 31, 1965. Jim Clark of Doon, Scotland, had buried an era in the first rear-engine car to ever win the Rich 500. The Offenhauser engine in its present form had had it, as Ford-powered cars swept 7 of the first 10 standings. The Ford Motor Company had finally ended the three-decade reign of the four-cylinder Offie engine that had won 17 straight Memorial Day Classics and 24 of the previous 27 races starting in 1934. Andy Granatelli has made the turbine a definite threat. This year, 3 have qualified. 2 are in the front row, and both have averaged over 170 miles per hour. The turbines, however, are not too popular with some of the drivers.
I don't like them. Well, if the rules aren't changed, if they're let like they are, the turbines obviously have an advantage in a properly designed automobile. And it definitely will obsolete millions of dollars worth of racing equipment, you know, to delve into it just a little bit. I personally am of my own personal belief, and I'm stuck with it, that the turbines don't really belong here because this is a race for automobiles, not airplanes.
Well, it's a fast race car. It's awfully expensive, and I don't know how the fans will react to not hearing anything. When you're out there watching one of them and he's running 165 all by himself, no one else on the track, you can't tell when the driver's on the gas or when he's off the gas. It's just silent. And I don't know how the fans are going to respond to this. But it is a fast race car. There's no getting around that.
Well, definitely, if they don't outlaw them, they're going to be here to stay. It's going to be an awful quiet race when they get all 33 of them out there, though. Well, I think right now the fans, these turbines, they're fascinating them because of the fact that they are an airplane engine, more or less. But when you get it all that way, then I don't think the fans would even like it because you'd almost have to run a lawnmower so the people listening on the radio wouldn't even know anything was going on.
I think probably next year, probably half the field will be turbines at the rate they're going now, if they finish the race. I think so. I think it'll be either two classes or it'll just be a struggle of piston engine against the jet engine, and they'll just try to even out the competition so both can run together.
Well, it's definitely going to make a change in racing if they keep on the turbine, because they're not going to their limit with the turbine.
It's a tense moment for drivers, car owners, and mechanics when the search for speed builds to a climax as past winners and sons of past winners get set to qualify for choice starting positions. Each year, the speeds get faster and faster. Is there a limit to how fast a car can go at Indianapolis?
Well, there no doubt is a limitation, but I don't think that we'll reach it within 10 years or so, and maybe not even then. The thing that keeps making the speed go up is we keep improving everything, the race car in general. The tires, I think, are probably the greatest advancement in speed that's been here in 15 or 20 years. Just in the last 6 or 7 years, the speeds have jumped 20 miles an hour. And most of this, I'd say 70% of this, is due to the tires. We also have new type machinery that we're running. The engines are putting out a little more power. The chassis are a little more sophisticated. It builds up our corner speed. This is the thing that makes you go faster on any racetrack, is getting through the corner faster. To do this, you have to have a chassis that works very well at high speed through the corner so that you can come off at a higher RPM or a higher speed to build up your straightaway speed.
You know, years ago they said it was impossible around 140, and then they said 150, and it's going right on up, as you say. So they're improving the breed of equipment, the tires, engines, and chassis and everything. So really, I'd be afraid to say that there's any certain stopping point.
Oh, I have my serious doubts that there's any limit to anything. 100 years ago, look at the progress. The airplanes 10 years ago, they said sound barrier was impossible. Now it's a sonic barrier. No, I don't think there's any limit.
Every year the corner speeds are better, and they're better tires, the cars handle better, so it's hard to tell. 4 or 5 years ago, they thought you wouldn't reach 150. Now they're running 170. So I imagine in another 3 or 4 years, they'll be running 180. The suspension system's on the cars, more horsepower, the engines, and better tires. Each year, one's a little bit ahead of the other, and then it takes a year or two for all three to catch up, and there's constant advances all the time.
No, they will never be no limit on this racetrack what they will reach, because they keep, you know, things keep turning over and changing every year. Like your piston displaced engines just went to turbines, and after turbines, it's allowed to be rockets or something. You don't know.
Fever has been a presentation of TV 18 Sports, brought to you by Hudson Furniture, 1105 Winchester Road, and by First Security National Bank.